It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and Cindy Haynes will be here to answer your questions about the plants in your life that you want to grow or grow better. We'll also talk about late spring blooming trees and leaf drop on crabapple trees. Call in with your questions at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and the conversation takes root just after the news. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Julie Englander, and we're talking plants with Extension Horticulturists Richard Geron and Cindy Haynes today. They'll take your questions about anything you want to grow or grow better. Call in at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or you can email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Welcome, Richard and Cindy. How are you today?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Let's start off with what we should know about late spring blooming trees. It's hard to believe that it's already late spring. I'm still reveling. There's no ice around anymore. I mean, it's just amazing to me. But give us a few pointers about late spring blooming trees, what we should know.
Right. But there are a lot of spring blooming trees. So we think of crab apples and all these other things that are fantastic, you know, in April and May. But as the season progresses, there are fewer and fewer trees that are in bloom. So in late spring, we only have a few, late spring and early summer and into summer. So what we've been noticing around campus are things like Japanese tree lilac, catalpa, even something called golden rain tree are kind of the three trees that dominate as far as having some color or some bloom, some interest in the landscape. These are not necessarily small trees. Some of the Japanese tree lilacs on campus are more than 20 feet tall, though we usually sell them as a kind of a 20-foot tall ornamental tree. And Richard and I were noticing as we were walking to the studio today that this Japanese tree lilac, while absolutely beautiful when it's in bloom, the fragrance of this bloom is not like your typical lilacs. Mm. So it's
very noticeable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Not always. I don't find it unpleasant, but it's very strong and can be a little bit overwhelming when it's close up. And it's different. So how would you describe it, Richard?
It's kind of a lilac type. A privet type.
Okay. Yeah.
Sickeningly sweet, kind of, if you're very close to it.
Pungent.
From a distance, it's more pleasant, but when you get very close to it, it can be a little bit overpowering. And you have these creamy white flowers, and when you get a whiff, you know exactly what it is.
Mm. A lot of people associate it, because it is a lilac, and it's got beautiful bark and nice foliage and this beautiful creamy white flower, they think it's going to be this incredibly fragrant, wonderful lilac-smelling type of a tree. And it's a little different. It's a little bit different. So nice tree, nice small tree, but it's still a little bit different.
So you maybe want to plant it further back from the house if you want one in your yard, if you have a large enough yard.
But fortunately, you know, it's like most blooming trees. It only blooms for a couple of weeks.
Okay, so not to worry.
Okay. So it just might have the windows closed and the air conditioner on that week or two that it's actually blooming.
Okay.
And then the other tree that we were going to mention was catalpa.
Catalpa, yeah, they're beautiful.
Absolutely.
Large leaves.
Huge
leaves. Everything about this plant is huge, and it can get very large. So this is a 50-foot-plus tree, huge flowers, and a little bit messy, produces a pod and drops a large leaf, but very interesting and nice to look at. Maybe not something I would put next to the house or a parking lot that's
going
to drop
a patio, off. Not a patio tree, but a nice tree for the backyard. It is very adaptable, which makes it great. It will grow in most soils.
It'll grow almost anywhere.
It's cold hardy. And so it's a nice addition because it's something different, and it does bloom when most other trees are not blooming.
Okay.
So those two trees can add a lot to your landscape because they bloom at an odd time.
Okay. Those are good things to know. We'll go to our callers now. Glenn in Des Moines is on the line. Welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. Glenn, what's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. I seeded a very large area with new grass seed about 4 weeks ago, and at the same time, the maple flyers, those seedlings, came down from surrounding maple trees and covered the entire area with these maple wings. And now I have an estimated number of seedlings all over this grass area. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether they're going to die out when I mow it or whether I have to do something with them.
Actually, repeated mowing should eventually kill them, so that's the good news. Just keep the area mowed, and that repeated mowing should kill them.
Okay. Oh, that's wonderful news.
Easy as that, Glenn.
I had as many trees as I have grass.
Well, I'm sure. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling, Glenn. We appreciate it. We'll go next to Alan in Des Moines. Alan, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Yes, I had a question about kohlrabi. I grow the white and purple kohlrabi, and this year I've had a lot of scarring on it, some cases covering maybe half of the bulb of the kohlrabi, and I was just curious what that might be.
I have no idea offhand. When you say scarring...
It's kind of a whitish-gray and almost like tiny little specks on it, almost like maybe you took your fingernail or something when it was young and made an indentation. That's why I don't know if it's some kind of pest or if it would be a fungus that would cause that. But it's very widespread. Probably 80% of the kohlrabi has it.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I would tend to think it would probably be insect-related rather than a fungal disease. That's just my inclination. But I'm not sure exactly what's responsible for it. You could just plant more and hope that the new crop would not be affected. You could send a sample into the plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State to determine the cause.
Okay.
But that would require a $20 fee. So it's up to you. I think I'd be inclined to plant some more. And then if it reoccurs, then try to identify it because it's come back again and it may come back again next year. So I'd plant some more and see if it comes back. And if it does, send a sample to the plant diagnostic clinic. You can do that directly yourself or bring it down to your county extension office.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. We appreciate it. Good luck. We'll go next to Joan in Charles City. Joan, hello. Welcome to Talk of Iowa with Richard Geron and Cindy Haynes. What's your question?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wonder what's the best fertilizer to use for my tomatoes. I've got three different fertilizers here with different numbers on them, and I just never know which one is the one I should use.
Okay, they're growing in the garden?
Yes.
Okay. What I'd probably do is, before you plant the garden, I would probably just go out with like a 10-10-10, which is an all-purpose garden fertilizer, and apply a small amount of that to the whole garden before you plant. And that should take care of most things. You really shouldn't need to fertilize again.
Oh, really? Okay.
Most Iowa soils are quite fertile, so we're just trying to maintain fertility by adding a small amount in the spring, and that should be it.
How much? This is probably I got 10 plants, and they're just in a small area. How much would you use?
For example, let's say you had a 10-by-10-foot garden, which is 100 square feet.
Uh-huh.
You would only apply about 1 or 2 pounds of that per 100 square feet, so not much at all.
Okay. Well, it's too late for that because they're already in. Now I have a 20-20-20, so maybe just a pound.
Well, right, maybe a half to a pound of that, right, because it's much more concentrated.
Yeah, right. And then, I've always, added fertilizer on as they started setting tomatoes, so I shouldn't do that.
Well, it's may not be necessary. Most Iowa gardens are quite fertile, that they have quite a bit of nitrogen, phosphate, and potash.
Uh-huh.
So most things will perform quite well on their own. Now,
okay.
If you want to take, let's say you do have your 20-20-20, if you want to take a few tablespoons, maybe 2 or 3 tablespoons of that, and just sprinkle that around the plant, I don't see a problem doing that.
To each one?
To each plant. Maybe one, I'd cut that back to maybe just 2 tablespoons per plant.
2 tablespoons, okay.
And just sprinkle it around it.
Okay. Yes, that's about what I've done in the past, and I just didn't know if I was doing the right thing or not. I'd like to ask you about some evergreens that my son has growing out at the farm. And when he planted them, they were about 30 inches tall, and they're 3 years old now. And he wondered if he should fertilize and water those. It had really been dry. We finally got rain here last night in the northern part of Floyd County, but we had rain here about a week ago. I suppose at least half to three-quarters of an inch, but they never got it out there, and he didn't know whether it's good to fertilize them or not. They're blue spruce, basically.
Yeah, typically when we're growing trees and shrubs, we really don't need to fertilize them because they can get everything they need directly from the soil, so there's typically no need to. Now, when you're planting a tree or shrub, that first year or two, you may need to water periodically when it's dry, so that is important. That does help, but typically no need to fertilize.
Well, they're 3 years old now.
Right. So if we had a really dry summer where it hadn't rained for several weeks, I would water the trees.
Okay.
But I don't see a need to fertilize them.
Uh-huh.
Thanks, Joan. We're going to move on. But
okay.
We appreciate
All right, thank
it.
You.
Thank you. We appreciate the call. We'll go to John in Beaverdale and... We have a few minutes before the break here. John, what's your question?
Well, I've got a Japanese barberry in my front yard that appears to be exhibiting symptoms of verticillium, what I think is verticillium wilt. The leaves are shriveling, turning a deep red or brown, and then they're falling off, leaving, you know, little branches broken. And I'm wondering if there's anything I can do about that. I've done a little research on the web, and most sources say, you know, cut everything from cut back the dead growth to dig up the plant and get rid of it, including the soil around the plant.
Well, if it were verticillium wilt, basically all the foliage on the affected branches would kind of wilt, turn brown and die, but all the foliage on that branch would do that. And when you see that, the normal response would be to go out and prune it out and get rid of it. Now, it may continue. And if it continues, you prune out those branches.
Okay.
If it continues further and becomes quite widespread, then you reach a point where you think, well, so much of the plant is affected, I'm just going to dig this up and destroy it. That may be the best response. But there's no fungicide that you can spray on the plant. You basically prune out the affected branches and then cross your fingers and hope for the best. Sometimes that's it. It doesn't reappear. But oftentimes it does reappear, and then you have to cut those out, too.
And Thanks. It's in the soil, so the surrounding plants would be affected, correct?
Depends on the plants and the plant species sometimes.
We're going to take a break here. John, we wish you luck with the Japanese barberry. You're listening to Horticulture Day and Talk of Iowa. We'll be back in about a minute with Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and Cindy Haynes. Call in at 1-866-780-9100. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and Cindy Haynes are here to answer your questions. Call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll go to Donna in Waterloo. Welcome to the program, Donna. What's your question?
Good morning.
Hello.
How are you?
Okay.
Our son wants to come over to our house and dig up some hostas and put them in their yard. Is this a good time to do it?
It's not the best time to do it, but hostas are tough, they're durable, and you can do it. If you can talk them into maybe postponing this to later in the season or early next spring, it's a lot easier, just because you don't have to deal with so much foliage when you're digging up and dividing a hosta. But if they're persistent and they're
willing to water quite often.
Yeah, and they're willing to care for them replanting, hostas can take it.
I told them I thought we could as long as they kept watering them consistently. They're going to obviously go into shock.
Right.
As long as they took care of them.
Right, Right, they won't have the root system once you dig them up and divide them, so they will need some babying, and that may be quite a bit of babying if it's a really hot, dry summer, so they might be watering or caring for them quite a bit.
Well, knowing kids, I think I might persuade them to wait until the fall. And, you know, I hope they're not listening.
If you could tell them to wait maybe until late August, when things are starting to cool down, even at that point in time, if they damage some of the foliage and in moving them, it will be okay. And that way root systems can kind of get growing first and they'll be perfectly beautiful next year. So,
thank you.
So postpone them for a month or two.
Will do. Thanks.
Thanks, Donna. Bye-bye. Bye. We'll go next to Patty. And Patty, I'm not sure where you're calling from, but you have a question about hostas as well. Is that right?
Des Moines.
Des Moines. Okay.
Something's eating mine. There are little
Uh-oh.
Holes in the leaves.
Slugs, maybe?
That would be my first thought. What does slugs look like?
They're snails without shells.
Correct.
So you wouldn't see them unless you were sometimes out at night.
Because they feed at night.
They're nocturnal.
And
tasty. Yeah. Yeah, you could. They do eat them in France. But you could also go and check and look underneath rocks or boards or, you know, other places during the day to see if you have them.
Another thing that you might see during the day would be if you go out and inspect the soil, or maybe if you have like a sidewalk or a patio, you might kind of see a light silvery trail on the surface.
Yeah, the slime trail, we call it.
That they leave behind. So you might see that where you don't actually see them. So if you have slugs, that's just kind of a common annoyance when you grow hostas. They kind of show up at some point, usually in late spring, early summer, and it becomes progressively worse during the growing season. But the hostas themselves typically are okay. They just don't look very attractive at that point. There are some slug baits that you can use. You can buy these at garden centers. But if you use those, you typically have to start using them early.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, it's probably a little bit too late because initially, the population is small, but it builds up very rapidly. And you have to really tamp them down early, otherwise they get out of hand very quickly. So you might try them. You might look for some of the slug baits. But at this point, it may be a little bit too late as far as control.
It's just unsightly.
Yes, it is.
And does it mean that you will have a huge slug population next year if you have one this year? It's kind of all weather dependent. And you will have some gardeners who will also talk about beer, maybe setting baits with old beer or a fermented
yeast. I just think they like beer.
You know, it doesn't necessarily control the population, particularly at this time, but it's fun to watch slugs drown themselves in beer.
Oh, dear.
I know. It's just kind of, well, I don't know. You feel like you're accomplishing something because you've killed a few slugs. But so the slug bait or little shallow dishes of beer or fermented yeast are some other possibilities, but it's probably not going to do a lot as far as controlling or preventing more holes from happening in your hosta leaves.
Guess just live with it, Patty.
Right.
I live in the Drake neighborhood, and during the Drake Relay, there were some parties in my neighborhood that didn't seem to help.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe it's not the slugs then.
And you will find that some varieties are fairly resistant.
Yeah.
While other varieties are just full of holes. So you'll find that too.
You can tell all your neighbors that you're running a slug resistant hosta trial so that you can see which hostas are resistant to slugs.
Good. Early next year, I should put out beer bait? Really?
Well,
for real?
Next spring, early, if you want to use a bait, that's the best time to start. It's very early in the year, like in May, is where you go out to your garden center. There are a couple materials that you can buy. One is a chemical, metaldehyde. The other is a naturally occurring material, so you have your choice there as far as what to use. But start to apply that early, like in May.
What are those?
They're slug baits, and they go by various product names like
Escargot. Or Sluggo.
Sluggo. They have these cute little names for the product, so.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you, Patty. Good luck.
Party down. Thank you.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Bye-bye now. Drunken slugs. Okay, now we're going to David in Dubuque. David, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Thank you for taking the call. I have a magnolia bush that is it's getting to be about too tall. It sits in front of the kitchen window, and it's done blooming. Mm-hmm. Is this a good time or a bad time to trim it down?
You can do some pruning on it. it might have been easier to do some pruning when it's dormant so you can actually kind of see some of the twigs. But it is a spring blooming tree or shrub, and now would be perfectly acceptable. Minimal pruning on it, thinning out is what I would suggest, so taking out some branches where they connect with another branch instead of topping or hedging it. That would just encourage more growth. So do some thinning out to control height, and then you won't have as much new growth, so you won't have to deal with this problem continually every year. Magnolias, in general, if they are one of the little girl series, which are more shrub-like, they can still get 10, 15, 20 feet tall. So they're still quite large shrubs.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
Thanks, David. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll go next to Nancy in Cedar Rapids. Welcome, Nancy. We have a few minutes before the break here. What's your question on Horticulture Day?
I'm just wondering about Oriental Bittersweet. I see it a lot in Cedar Rapids, and I have a lot of wooded areas, and I'm seeing it grow. I've tried putting the stump killer on, but it just seems to come back.
Well, it can be hard to kill. I guess I would be inclined to use Roundup and just cut it off near the ground and then apply the Roundup directly to the cut surface. And if it resprouts, I would do it again. And hopefully, eventually over time, you would get enough into the root system to kill it, and then it would be dead.
Okay. So it's just a matter of persistence, then.
I think it is, with some things where one application might not be sufficient.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Nancy. We appreciate the call. We have an email from Craig in Des Moines. He asks, I have a clump of asters planted 4 years ago. They're already 16 inches tall. How do I pinch or prune them to keep them from becoming 4 foot tall and leggy by the time they bloom in the fall? And when should I do this so-called pinching or pruning?
You can pinch or prune some taller asters or mums. Actually, now's a pretty good time to do this. We usually say any kind of pruning that you do to asters or mums, you really need to kind of do that before the 4th of July. So we try to actually go through a couple of pinching. So one, when they're just about 6 inches tall, you can do a little pinch, which is just taking out a little bit of the top of the growing point, and that forces it to branch. And then you can do a second pinch when it's about a foot to foot and a half tall, and then force it to branch even more. What this does is creates a shorter, more compact plant, and usually has a lot more flowers.
Mm, okay. And another email from Jeff in Carbon Cliff, Illinois. He's wondering if the dandelions that grow in his yard are the same as the ones that are edible. Can I eat the leaves of dandelions that grow in my yard?
Yes, you can, if you don't spray.
Oh, that's a good point. Good point. Don't spray the dandelions. Okay, we're going to take a 5-minute break, but when we return, Horticulture Day continues with Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Cindy Haynes. They'll be here to take your questions about the plants in your life. You can call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in a few minutes.
The Environmental Protection Agency finalizes new health standards for one kind of air pollution. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Back in 1998, the American Lung Association sued the EPA to prod the agency to further reduce air pollutants that cause health problems. Among those pollutants was sulfur dioxide, known for causing acid rain. The primary sources of the pollutant are coal-burning power plants and other industrial plants. Sulfur dioxide emissions are capped at yearly limits, but this new rule also restricts short spikes in the emissions. Deborah Sprentz is a consultant to the American Lung Association. She says this new rule is a good first step to reduce the pollution.
To protect the health of people, especially those with asthma and other respiratory conditions, from breathing these short-term bursts of sulfur dioxide that can make them sick and send them to the hospital and even contribute to premature death.
States will have a couple of years to comply with the new rule, but have put in place today a projected 60 counties, mostly in the eastern half of the nation, would be out of compliance. Well, California could answer the question, paper or plastic, with a law. The California Assembly has approved a ban on plastic bags. If the California Senate also approves, grocery stores, convenience stores, and pharmacies will no longer be able to use single-use plastic bags. It's an effort to cut down on plastic bag trash. Less than 5% of plastic bags are recycled in California. The environmental group Heal the Bay says that means cities spend millions of dollars each year to collect and dispose of plastic bag waste. Some of it gets into waterways and the ocean, harming animal life. Paper bags will be allowed, but only if they contain at least 40% post-consumer recycled content. This is the Environment Report. For decades, people in American cities have relied on farmers out in the country to grow the fruits and vegetables we eat. But a new generation of farmers says there's no reason to keep agriculture out of the city. And Dornfeld has more on that.
Sean Conroe and Amber Banks both wanted to start a farm in the middle of the city.
There are a lot of neighborhoods that don't have access to healthy, fresh produce. And if they do, it can be very expensive. And so we see unused space as a great place to grow food that will make it more accessible for people.
They call their project Alley Cat Acres. Sean created a website to recruit volunteers and donations. Within a week, they were offered a plot of land between two houses in South Seattle. Conroe says 20 volunteers work for 6 weekends to turn the grassy land into what it is now, a farm.
We have spinach, onions, radish, lettuce and chard that's all ready to be harvested right now.
There are carrots and green onions and peas, beans and turnips.
And then strawberries.
We did not expect there to be this much food already, so things are definitely off to a good start.
The Alley Cats have harvested nearly 200 pounds of produce so far. They've donated most of it to local food banks. Exposing city dwellers to the joys of growing food is one of the Alley Cats' missions. They invite school groups to the farm to help out. And Amber Banks says they want the same people who get food donations to know how to work the soil.
You know, because we're not going to be around forever. You know, people are going to eventually have to take over these gardens.
And that might be the big accomplishment. Feed a city dweller veggies and they eat for a day. Teach them to garden and it'll be zucchinis for everyone.
That's kind of corny. That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron and Cindy Haynes are here to answer your questions. Call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go to Kathy in Iowa City. Kathy, welcome to the program. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In Iowa City, in my house, or around my house, I have a lot of ash trees. They were planted in 1954. They're very well taken care of. But now with the ash beetle knocking on our door, what I'd like to do is to start some replacement trees. But, of course, I don't want to get rid of the ash trees that I have now. Ash trees give me a lot of shade. Could you give me some suggestions for some trees that could get a start?
Well, the good news is that if we as humans do good job of containing this, it may be several years before you have to deal with the problem. So it may not be immediate. It may be 5, 10, maybe more years beyond that. So as far as other trees, I guess I would look at oaks and maples and lindens. Those are very good trees, shade trees, if you have the space. I would plant some of those. And then maybe look at some of the more unusual plants, like maybe possibly a bald cypress.
Kentucky coffee tree.
Kentucky coffee tree, maybe a catalpa. Some of the more unusual plants that you can still find that do well in Iowa.
Think diversity. So, so instead of planting just one other species of tree to replace some of your ash, think of many different types of trees so that we learn from this lesson.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And all of these trees could make it okay with all the shade that's already there?
Well, that's a concern. You want to try to find an opening where you can put these.
Mm-hmm.
So that they won't be, that they won't grow and become rather lopsided,
right?
Because of the shading. So you want to try to find an opening and put them in there,
right.
And they'll be fine for several years. They should be.
Okay.
So try to stay away from the canopy of the other trees if you can.
Right. Right. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. Appreciate the call. We'll go next to. Susan in Fairfield. Susan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm concerned about sycamore trees. I'm in Fairfield and mm-hmm. on campus here at the university and also in town. The sycamores don't look good.
No, they don't.
They're starting to leaf out, but there's brown leaves that look like they had mm-hmm. emerged, you know, previously that you know, just didn't make it. I'm wondering what's going on and can anything be done to help?
Well, actually, they're okay. They don't look so good right now, but they're going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
They have anthracnose, which is a very common fungal disease that we see in the spring.
Uh-huh.
It occurs on a number of trees, ash, sycamore, maple, oak, hickory. It's most common, though, on the ash and the sycamores.
Uh-huh.
And with the sycamore, some years when the weather conditions in May are quite favorable, it can be quite severe.
Mm-hmm.
Where they will lose much of their foliage.
Mm-hmm.
The initial foliage might kind of dry up and turn kind of a grayish brown color and then fall off the tree. And so you may have trees that are almost bare in late May, early June.
Mm-hmm.
The cool, wet weather in May was the culprit. Those conditions are quite favorable for anthracnose.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gotten warmer and drier since then, and so the weather conditions have become unfavorable for the anthracnose.
Mm-hmm.
The tree itself is still growing
mm-hmm.
and will do so for another few weeks. And so the foliage that develops later on this spring and early summer should not be affected. It should be basically normal looking.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end of June, early July, the sycamores should look a lot better than they do right now.
Oh, good. Well, that's real good.
And so we don't have to do anything.
Uh-huh.
They should recover on their own. But this occurs to some extent every year. Some years the damage is very, very minor. You don't even notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Other years, like this year, everybody notices.
I see. So, well, I'm real glad to know that they're going to be okay, and the warmer, dry weather is going to help the trees recover.
Right.
Good.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much for your help.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. And there's also something else going on with crabapple trees this time of year. Is that
accurate? Well, they're dropping too.
Okay.
It's not anthracnose in this case. Mm. It's apple scab. But the weather again in May was the culprit, that cool, wet weather in May. So with the crabapples, you'll see spotting of the foliage, kind of dark green or black spots on the leaves, and then they may turn yellow and fall off. And some crab apples are extremely susceptible to apple scab. Other ones are resistant. But you might start seeing a leaf drop on crab apples. And if you do, it's due to apple scab. It's not going to kill the trees. Those varieties that are susceptible to it may lose a fairly large percentage of their leaves, maybe 25%, maybe more.
Mm.
And so they won't be as full. They won't be as attractive this summer, but they're not dying, and you don't have to worry about spraying them at this point. In fact, spraying them at this point wouldn't do any good. So,
okay, that's
but good. When yeah. you buy a crab apple in the future, mm-hmm. let's say you go to the garden center, make sure you buy a variety that is apple scab resistant.
Oh, okay. That's good news. Okay, and good ideas. All right, we'll go now to Ken in Mason City. Ken, welcome to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. What's your question for Richard Giron and Cindy Haynes?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a large, and I believe it's a soft maple in my backyard. It's probably 40 to 50 years old. And I noticed last fall that the foliage kind of got a lighter yellow shade to it. And then when it leafed out this year, it's also light yellow. And it seems like there's similar trees in my neighborhood. They don't have that light yellow shade to the leaves on it. And I'm kind of worried. I'm wondering what's going on.
Well, if it's a silver maple...
It's not a silver maple, no.
Well, it produces seed in the spring of the year.
Excuse me? Yeah, it's seeded out. It's got the helicopters.
Yeah. And those seeds formed and dropped this spring?
Yes, they did.
Okay. Then that's probably a silver maple. Some people call it soft maple, but the common name is silver maple.
Okay.
And
doesn't have the silvery on the bottom of the leaves.
So I'm guessing that's what it is, because they do produce seeds in the spring of the year. Most of the other maples, their seeds don't fall to the ground until late summer or fall.
Okay.
So if they drop in the spring, it's probably silver maple. As far as the problem, it may be a nutrient deficiency, and that's related to the soil pH, where if the pH is fairly high, the trees may have difficulty absorbing enough nutrients. Specifically in this case, I think it's manganese, where they're simply not able to absorb that. Even though it's in the soil in sufficient quantity, when the pH is fairly high, they're simply not able to absorb it. It's very hard to correct, because if you simply added more manganese to the soil, it still wouldn't, the tree still could not absorb it in sufficient amounts. So it's kind of chlorotic. The foliage is kind of a yellow-green, but if you if you examine the leaf very carefully or closely, you'll see that the tissue near the major veins is a fairly dark green in comparison to the rest of the leaf, which is more of a yellow-green. So if you see that pattern, that would typically suggest a nutrient deficiency, and in this case, manganese. As far as what we do, it's very hard to correct. We really can't do much of anything in most cases. Now, if this is a silver maple, they seem to tolerate it quite well. Even though they look a little bit odd with their yellow-green foliage, they seem to do okay as far as growing. So oftentimes we may not do much of anything.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah, at least it's a healthy tree in a sense, but just needs the nutrients, Ken. So I guess you just leave it alone and enjoy it as it is. How's that sound?
Well, it kind of looks, it stands out.
Yeah, it does. They do stand out. Now, sometimes weather conditions may make it even worse. Typically, when you have very, very wet soils, that makes it even harder for the trees to absorb the nutrients, and sometimes it becomes even more severe when we have a wet spring and summer.
What about if the roots are growing into the sewer lines, because I had them cleaned out this...
I don't think that should, if it's done correctly, that shouldn't have much impact on the tree itself.
I know, but I was just wondering if that's why it's, because it kind of looks like a houseplant that had too much water.
Yeah, no, that shouldn't really affect the absorption of nutrients from the soil.
Okay.
Thanks, Ken.
Well, good. I just didn't really want to lose it, and it's been concerning me.
Looks like you won't. Well, thank you for calling.
All right. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.
Appreciate it.
We have an email from Katie in Davenport. She says, I planted several rose bushes last spring, and they seem fine. Earlier this spring, however, when I returned after a 10-day trip late this May, all of their leaves had turned completely brown and crispy. What happened? Are these rose bushes toast?
Well, I don't think they're toast. I think what may have damaged them may have been the rose slug.
Mm.
It's actually not a true slug. It's a kind of a pale green caterpillar-like insect, and they're about half inch in length, and they typically feed on the underside of the foliage. And what they do is they basically consume most of the green tissue of the leaf, and they leave behind just a very thin layer of plant tissue or leaf tissue plus the major veins. So when you go out and look at it, the remaining tissue kind of turns kind of a light brown or tan. And so you have this kind of window pane appearance because you can see the major veins very clearly. And you have this very thin, kind of light brown tissue that you can kind of see through. So if you have that window pane appearance, then maybe the rose slug or rose sloth fly caused the damage. Now, at this point, they might be gone already. They're kind of a springtime thing, and they're there for a few weeks, and then they're gone basically most of the rest of the year. But if that's the cause of the damage, the rose should keep on growing, and the newer foliage should be okay.
Okay, good. All right, so good news there in a sense. We'll go next to Denise in Ames. Denise, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question on Horticulture Day?
I do not have the good Iowa soil. I have a very sandy soil, and I've been working on improving it with doing compost to leaves and manure, but I have a long way to go. I had the soil analyzed. They said everything was fine except for nitrogen. Don't add anything but nitrogen. So if I'm doing a compost, I'm adding everything. How do I boost my nitrogen content?
Well, you can add things like blood meal, which are strictly nitrogen, nothing else in them. So you can find some of those products at a garden center where they're strictly nitrogen and nothing else. So like blood meal is one, ammonium sulfate is another, strictly nitrogen, no phosphate, no potash.
And would I just work that in this fall then and about just whatever the container says to use? Or?
Yeah, you can use those in the I'd probably apply them in the spring of the year because nitrogen is very mobile. And if you apply them in the fall and we have a very wet year, some of that's going to leach out of the soil and not be of any use the next year. So you want to do that typically in the spring.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks for calling, Denise.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We'll move on to Chad in Creston, Iowa. Chad, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thanks. I have strawberries we got through mail order, and they're not doing well. I was wondering what the best conditions of growing strawberries are.
As far as growing them, they're not hard. Basically, you need a well-drained soil and also a site that receives at least 6 to 8 hours of direct sun during the day. So if you have those two things, they should be okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
If you have a poorly drained soil, they're very prone to root diseases, where the plants will basically die if you have a wet, poorly drained site. So make sure it's well drained. If they don't get enough sun, they don't produce well.
Okay, yeah, they're in the sun, and we got like a pyramid-shaped circular object going around them. So
okay,
hopefully they'll sprout. When do they usually bloom?
Well, when you plant them in the spring, they may not bloom much at all the first year. In fact, if you have June-bearing strawberries and you plant them in the spring, you should actually pinch off the blooms if they do try to flower. If you have an ever-bearing variety, those blooms early in the spring should be pinched off. Any blooms that form after July 1 can be allowed to go ahead and fruit.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Chad. Good luck with the strawberries. We appreciate the call. Bye-bye. We'll go next to Andrew in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Andrew, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a number of fruit plants in our backyard. We have blueberries, some well-established grapevines, rhubarb, and strawberry. It's getting to be quite difficult to mow around these things, and I was wondering about building up some kind of landscaping boxes with some timbers and just mulching, cutting the grass out and mulching. And my question is about using some found timbers that have creosote in them. And also if the mulch could affect the soil pH and if that might cause the grapes, blueberries, some problems down the road.
The creosote issue is always difficult to answer. I don't think that would be a huge issue using it, even though it has been treated with a preservative. As far as placing these around plants, you really don't want to raise the soil level around things like blueberries, because if you did, the blueberry plant is a very shallow-rooted plant. And if you built a raised bed around a blueberry plant and then filled that in with maybe 3 or 4 inches of soil, that could actually kill the plant.
Okay.
Because some of the roots would be so deep that they would basically suffocate and die. So you really shouldn't raise the grade around a tree or a shrub. Now, you can build up an area, fill it with soil, and then transplant things like strawberries into that raised bed, but you typically don't want to raise the grade around trees and shrubs.
And you can mulch around these trees and shrubs. A couple of inches, maybe 3 inches of an organic mulch is just fine. It should not alter the pH much. You won't see any significant difference there. So mulching is okay, and maybe that's just what you do to kind of prevent the grass from growing so that you don't have to mow in that area. And it's the easiest thing to do because then you wouldn't even need the timbers or treated with creosote as an edging.
And the most problematic one are these grapevines. And would that be fine to kind of add some mulch around those? I mean, I know that the blueberries are actually kind of lowest on my priority list of kind of troubling to mow around. What about the grapes? Do they present any specific problems of mulching around them?
No. You can just go out there and destroy the existing vegetation beneath it, and then once that vegetation is killed, then you can apply wood chips, some other type of mulch, and they should be fine. You could use grass clippings, shredded leaves, anything that you have on hand that should basically keep out the weeds and also conserve moisture around the plants.
I kind of spaced off on what I was going to ask you. Well, I appreciate the help.
Okay, thanks, Andrew.
Right.
Good luck.
Bye-bye
now. We have an email from Laura in Des Moines. She asks, I planted Concord grapes this spring in a large planter on my deck. I see there are 2 grape clusters with about 10 grapes total. Will it produce more grapes this year? Should I prune or do something to increase the amount of grapes?
Well, I think what I would do would be to maybe at some point either this year or next year plant it in the ground. That in a planter, I just don't think it's going to be very productive just because of the small growing space. Grapes have a very deep root system. They need a lot of space for the roots. And so growing them in a container, I don't think is going to be very productive.
Okay. And we'll go to Mark in Ames. Mark, welcome to the program. What's your question on Horticulture Day?
Hi. I'm building a new house, and I'm a fan of the kind of the moss look in between sidewalk stones. The sidewalk I'm putting in, though, is a south-facing sidewalk. There's going to be a lot of light. And so, is there some alternative to doing it myself? I'm going to make the stones myself out of concrete. And is there something I can kind of plant, if I space them an inch or two apart? Is there something I can plant in there that would kind of grow around these concrete stones?
Well, and it's a good question to ask. Moss is probably not going to work because it likes that kind of shaded, moist area, which this is not it. But there are other things like creeping thyme, which are very green, and they like the opposite conditions, the sunny, well-drained conditions. You can also go to your garden center and look for maybe some sedum or other things that they're selling now as steppables, which you can kind of put in between different stepping stones. Regardless of what kind of stepping stone it is, they usually do pretty well if there's not too much traffic. Something like thyme, the creeping thyme, can tolerate quite a bit of traffic, but if you're, 400 people walking on it at one time, nothing can handle that. But
yeah, it won't be a lot of traffic.
Yeah, so things along those lines, those steppables, which are some sedums and some creeping thyme is another one, will actually love those conditions of the sunny, kind of hot, well-drained in between the cracks of different rocks and stones.
Steppable sedums.
There's sedums or sometimes a creeping thyme. And there's a few other species too.
Okay. And then do you have any suggestions for a fast-growing tree? Because I don't have any trees on this lot, and I want to kind of get something going for shade.
I would look at a wide variety of trees, but realize that some of the fastest growing trees are not really good shade trees because they are also weak wooded. So the fastest trees may not be the best bet. But I would look at things like, for example, a red oak. Okay, they grow fairly fast, even though they have a bad reputation as far as growing slow. Maybe a honey locust. maybe one of the Freeman maples, which are crosses between silver maples and red maples. They grow fairly fast, too.
Thanks, Mark. We're out of time. Yeah, good luck. Bye-bye. Well, another horticulture day done, but we'll be back next week. We'd like to thank Richard Giron and Cindy Haynes for their expertise today. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. We had technical assistance by Christina Sarnelli. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Julie Englander. Thanks for joining us.